You could be forgiven for thinking that London stages are currently overrun with men who are terrified of their feminine side. In The Guardian this week, Corinne Redgrave described how the drugs he took for prostate cancer in 2001 blocked his testosterone production and transformed the coarse, manly texture of his chest hair into girly fluff. He was asked at this time to play King Lear for a radio production. As he studied the text, he realised that, like himself, Lear was scared of losing his masculinity. His worry about crying in critical encounters, his discomfort with such qualities as pity and mercy, and his need to surround himself with unruly knights were all symptomatic of this fear. At one point, he exclaims to Goneril, "I am ashamed that thou hast power to shake my manhood thus." As Redgrave brings his assertively male Lear to the West End, audiences also have the chance to see the first two of the three Macbeths to hit central London this month. Danny Sapani's dictatorial African warlord makes clear his struggles with gender when he dons a pink wig towards the end of the play, picking up on a West African rite of passage where young men must acknowledge the female side of themselves in order ultimately to escape it. Simon Russell Beale's much more existential Macbeth has no time for such rituals. Instead, like so many Macbeths before him, he looks to his woman to shore up his masculinity. I'm Rachel Halliburton, and with me today to discuss these plays are Charles Spencer of the Daily Telegraph, David Benedict of Bloomberg, and Heather Neal, freelance critic. I'll start by talking about Max Stafford Clarke's production, which plunges audiences into the dark heart of African politics. Meticulously researched, it links 20th century Africa with 11th century Scotland by creating echoes of Idi Amin's regime. Amin famously appointed himself King of Scotland, which was one of the least ambitious of his aims, given that other titles included His Excellency President for Life and Lord of all the beasts of the earth and fishes of the sea. Amin may not have truly merited any of these titles outside his dreams, but the nightmarish menace of his regime is evoked here, as audience members going into the auditorium are roughly questioned and searched by actors dressed as soldiers. Stafford Clarke avoids being oversimplistic in the political parallels he conjures up. So while 1970s Uganda provides a template, he also alludes to Sudan in the 90s. By making Monica Dolan's Lady Macbeth the only white character, he creates another set of images for the production, which feed off the story of Emma McCune, the headstrong and attractive English aid worker, who shocked fellow workers when she married local warlord Riek Machar. Because of her fierce loyalty to him, malicious whisperers referred to her as Lady Macbeth whenever she came to the UN to argue for more aid. The label may have been unfair, but through evoking her situation, Stafford Clarke raises provocative questions about how a woman and an outsider asserts power in a war-torn society. Charlie, Macbeth is a play which one critic has argued needs to inspire a sense of claustrophobia in order to work. Max Stafford Clarke has turned this into a promenade production. How did it work for you?
It's interesting this, because in fact I went and saw this production originally in Oxford when it was at the start of its tour, and it did worry me then. It was staged in the Oxford Playhouse, and we sort of started in the carpentry shop, and then we sat on the stage, and it was a rather odd, sort of slightly elderly audience, and I found myself, you know, the tension seemed to me to be completely dissipated by trooping round, and I spent a lot of time worrying about this poor old lady on a Zimmer frame who had to negotiate steps and all that, and it didn't work for me. I could see it was interesting, and I think that the central idea of, you know, transposing it to Africa is a really good one, and secondly works really well. I mean, it just seems to me that the whole idea worked, but the production didn't work for me there particularly, because I found it distracting, and my view of Macbeth is it always works in the best in the smallest possible space, and this, you know, we were wondering about. But I went back to it in Wilton's because I felt I knew that there was something about this production, and for me it worked brilliantly in Wilton's. Partly because the venue itself is so atmospheric, secondly because I think the performance have really deepened and gained in strength. I mean, I think both Macbeth, Danny Sapani as Macbeth and Monica Dolan as Lady Macbeth are two of the best I've ever seen. But thirdly, because Wilton's itself has just got such a wonderful atmosphere. It's so, you know, it's a semi-derelict classic Victorian music hall in the East End. And it's got the feel of, I thought, of an old colonial mission house. I mean, it actually looks like that, and it's like, you know, the Brits have long gone, and it's now this mission house, once Christian mission house, has become a place for voodoo, and it's terribly decayed, and I just found the whole thing magnificent. And there's also one bit which I must mention, I have never ever seen the Disastrous Dinner Party better staged, and people were literally jumping out of their skins when Banquo made his appearance. And I think it's terrific.
And we'll come on to exactly how that happens later. I mean, I do agree with you very much about the special atmosphere of Wilton's Music Hall, but I also have an issue with things that are spoken there, because having first seen it for the South African Mysteries, where there was singing and the whole roof seemed to take off, I have subsequently noticed that dialogue can get swallowed up, and I did find that quite a lot for the opening scene, which for me dissipated the energy of the production. David, how did you find it?
Well, you've taken the words right out of my mouth. It's a notoriously difficult venue to play for speech. Virtually every single play I've ever seen there, I've thought, did the director not spend much time standing around the venue doing sound checks before they booked this space, which is fantastically, as Charlie says, atmospheric, and it's because it's semi-derelict. It's got bits of all sorts of eras, so almost whichever era you set your show in, there'll be some resonance. It's got the versatility that modern theatre designers dream of and never manage to achieve. I think that the production as a whole works magnificently for most of the reasons that Charlie's already given, and because of the Wilton's business. For me, yes, most of the first scenes that are played up on the balcony get entirely lost because the verse speaking is not strong enough, and because the acoustic swallows it all up.
It's in French, isn't it? The witches are.
The witches are. But once you start getting the rest of the kind of the setup of the play, people are doing too much shouting basically, and it just echoes across the space. My problems with the production turn me into the oldest of fogies. It's to do with the quality of the acting and the quality of to use that disgusting term, verse speaking, which gave me enormous amounts of problems. However, I think that the control of the production and the idea of the production is terrific and does completely rejuvenate the play, and certainly most of the young audience that I saw it with there were pretty glued.
Yes, yes. Heather, how did the energy of the production sustain itself for you?
Well, I found it quite gripping, and although I agree that Wilton's can be very difficult sometimes to hear people, and maybe I was just pushing further to the front than the rest of you, I don't know, but this time I didn't have a problem, and I found the whole thing very refreshing because it was such a different perspective. We're so used to mining the psychology of the leading characters. This time, instead of being there, as it were, in our minds, their counsellors or whatever, we were in fear. We were part of a society where violence had taken over. And to see things from the perspective of those who suffered at the hands of Macbeth, I thought was quite remarkable.
Yes, we were his subjects almost.
Yes, we were.
And we were sort of or courtiers or something. And we were actually in, and I think that whole bit where the long middle section of the play, and we were actually sitting in the room where, you know, the council room really, which is almost the Macbeth's living room, and eavesdropping on what's going on.
Yes, yeah. I think it made me terrified in a way that Macbeth doesn't usually do.
Yeah.
Although I also felt that because of this, I knew less about Macbeth as a person by the end, and in fact, that didn't seem to be the main point. It wasn't of particular interest. He was a person in power who could do you damage.
And I think that there's one other point about what you're connecting up, what you're both saying, is the fact it happens in light. You know, we're not in a darkened theatre. We are not removed from them. So when we are either his subjects or, you know, we are people that they recognise. We're not doing fourth wall acting, or we'll pretend there's an audience not there, we'll just get on with our psychology on the stage. You do feel you are literally part of the action because they can eyeball you and you can be seen being seen by them, and that really does charge up the atmosphere.
And that was one of the things I did like about the opening scene, is I had Danny Sapani actually came right up to me and was kind of staring me in the face as he was delivering some of his lines, and you know, that's something no other stage Macbeth I've seen has ever matched. Can we talk a bit about Danny Sapani, who is from the start he's a very forceful presence. He's a true soldier. You really believe that he could kill, and I think this is a very relevant aspect of Macbeth to pick up on in the light of what we're going to be discussing later.
It's quite rare too. I mean, it's not. I've often thought, you know, oh dear, I just wouldn't believe that this man has just done what we've been told.
Yes,
and in this case, You do. You actually believe he could just have come in from killing.
So Heather, I mean, do you want to expand on that? I mean, how did that sort of more bloodthirsty side of him work?
Well, he's a tremendously forceful presence, as you say, very handsome, rugged person who you believe could lead people and persuade people to do what he wants them to. He also made me believe that he was very close to witchcraft and magic all the time, that part of his strength came from that. So that, for instance, when the dagger appears, he doesn't seem particularly surprised, and you think, well, this is part of his worldview. You know, he expects odd things to happen because he feels himself to be in league with other forces anyway before the Weird Sisters appear.
Charlie, what did you think of Sopanis before?
I thought it was terrific, actually. I mean, he wasn't interested in a great deal of introversion and introspection. It was done very, but what was overpowering was the physical presence. And I think what he really got, and this is what we get so rarely in Macbeth, you really got the feeling that this was a man enthralled and ensnared by evil. I mean, evil reeked off him, didn't it, at the key moments? And it's not often, I mean, most actors these days want to apologise for Macbeth, but Sopanis didn't do any of that. He was just an old-fashioned villain, except, of course, he wasn't old-fashioned. He was a very modern villain, a very recognisable villain, the kind of villain that we shudder from when we see them on the telly. I thought he was magnificent. I mean, it's not the deepest or the most complex Macbeth you're ever likely to see, but it's certainly the most physically powerful and spellbinding I've ever seen, I think.
I'm interested that you found that, Charlie, because on a second viewing, certainly. On the first viewing, my one and only appearance at the production, my big problem with the show was Sopanis, who I think does the broad brushstrokes incredibly well. All the things that you and Heather have outlined about the performance, I sort of agree with, except that they felt to me to be deeply unchanging, and that you don't get the doubt, you don't get the fear. I just, for me, maybe it was the night I saw it, it was all very much on one note. He didn't change that much. And that basically my big problem with the production as a whole is that it was fantastically secure and strong in conception, and actually the execution of a lot of it left me feeling somewhat disengaged, because not enough of the performances were subtly delineated enough to see the gradations of the pain and the terror and the fear and the anger and the tribal stuff. I could see all those elements and thought, my God, that's an amazing way of doing the text. And in a way, ironically, it's no surprise. Max Stafford Clarke is the most important director of new writing in the country, and he treats Macbeth like you would treat a new play, rather than sort of... He's not doing some strange interpretation in the way that, you know, a director that constantly just redoes classics will merely apply it to. He's looked at it and gone, what is this writer doing? What world is he conjuring up? And then finding a kind of, is it Eliot that said, objective correlative? You know, you've got a world that's consistent in a way that a new writer would be conjuring up that world.
Yes.
I mean, I'd like to kind of go into what he's done with the African backdrop, you know, more, because novelist Giles Foden wrote in the introduction that Macbeth is the most performed Shakespeare in Africa. I thought that was a fascinating observation to start off with. But what did you think specifically? I mean, we agree that the African setting wakes it up, but what do you think specifically it did to the text?
Well, I think specifically it makes sense of all the magic in the play. And just, you know, we begin with a voodoo ritual, and suddenly the witchcraft that seems exotic in many classical productions of the play suddenly seems to be absolutely, this is at the heart of their lives, this is their religion. So there's that side of it. And then the other side of it is that what Macbeth does is what so many African dictators has done. You know, he kills his way to the crown, and he doesn't give a fuck about anyone else. And there is very little sense of a conscience. And I absolutely agree with David. You will see endless and probably always a more subtle Macbeth than this, but I don't think you'll often see a stronger one. And it isn't a complete portrait, but I don't think increasingly, the more Shakespeare I see, I don't really believe anymore that that production should aim to be authoritative or complete. I'd much rather have this, which is done in very broad brush strokes. It's sort of like a Rolf Harris picture compared with a Watteau, really, but I'd rather have the vigour and spare me the sort of really considered but actually rather dead production.
Yes, I quite agree. I think it'd be a wonderful production to see if it was your first Macbeth, but on the other hand, I hope that most people would see more than one Macbeth in their lives anyway. This would not be the only one.
Just before we move on, I feel we can't go on without mentioning the White Lady Macbeth, Monica Dolan. What do you think that did, casting a white actress in this role? Did it add anything to the play for you?
Well, I don't know whether it was the casting of her or the way she played it. I found her rather one note and just rather bossy, actually. I didn't find that there was very much insight.
Yes. I couldn't understand the way when you first saw her, she was sitting on the sofa with her legs extremely wide apart, yes, reading this letter. And I just couldn't understand that. It wasn't followed through in the performance. You know, she wasn't that much more sexual than other Lady Macbeths either.
One thing I did like was the presence of children in that household. It was a place where families lived together. Mm-hmm. There was a normal domesticity which was disrupted by politics, and that lent even more weight to what happened in the Macduff household, I thought.
Speaking of the Macduff household, I would like to flag up Kevin Harvey as Ross, who I thought was terrific.
Very, very,
and he's just been nominated for an Olivier for his performance in Yellow Man at Hampstead. He's got the most incredible voice. It's so low, it's right down at the bottom of his register virtually with no effort, and that makes him look terribly relaxed on stage, because he doesn't have to push to give authority. And the scene where Max Stafford Clark makes him murder Macduff's children becomes really, really powerful, because this very quiet, very still man is forced into an act of violence that was really genuinely shocking.
We come to John Caird's production of Macbeth, which opened last night at the Armada. In contrast with Max Stafford Clarke's socially realist take, this production presents a world of shadows, a philosophical purgatory where nothing is as it truly seems. Against Christopher Oram's atmospheric mottled set, the three weird sisters look as if they could dissolve at a glance, while Neil Austin's lighting design allows Simon Russell Beale to slip in and out of darkness. Russell Beale himself revels in these visual ambiguities as he teases out the existential subtleties of his situation, revealing this Macbeth as a corrupt philosopher king rather than a pugnacious warlord. David, can we start by talking about the way the production played with light and dark on a visual level, because it was quite striking.
I have absolutely no problems with this production in terms of its look. I think it is really, really well designed. The combination of Christopher Oram and Neil Austin has already been shown off to tremendous effect, and to award-winning effect, in fact, in Caligula at the Donmar Warehouse, and here working in the obviously somewhat similar scaled space of the Almeida. They do work wonders. There's a basically... somebody sitting next to me said, I rather miss the cauldron. And I think that maybe we've got a circular stage which sort of gives you a cauldron effect. It's a white stage. It looks like it's going to be a revolve. In fact, it stays completely stationary. But the gap between the central circle and the frame that surrounds it gives you a tiny bit of light through which shafts of light come straight up. Most of the lighting in this show is vertical. There's very little side light. And people get caught in it and trapped in it.
I just thought it was a perfectly competent, rather dreary design. I can't see what you're all on about. It didn't start. I mean, you know, it was efficient and it was minimal. But I can't see that it had added anything particularly. It might have just as well been done in a black box, as far as I was concerned.
So did the production work for you at any other level?
No. I think this is probably the most disappointing production so far this year. I mean, there was huge expectation for Simon Russell Beale playing Macbeth, and he's an actor I revere, I think, possibly more than any other. And it seemed to me that you could see what he was doing. The interpretation of his performance to try and make Macbeth seem like Hamlet, which he played with such acclaim, and it was to make him much more than the bloody villain. I mean, very much, it was the absolute opposite end of what Danny Sapani was doing in the Macbeth we've already discussed. It was to make him seem thoughtful, aware of where he was going, still doing it because of ambition, and then finding himself in a kind of existential hell at the end where nothing mattered anymore. I can see all that, but a Macbeth that doesn't actually scare you at any moment, that talks so slowly. I said in my review that during the Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow speech, you should have got down to Starbucks, had a coffee and come back, and he'd be telling you about it. It's still a tale told by an idiot, and that speech is only 10 lines long. It was something I'd never seen Simon Russell Beale do before. I thought it was a self-indulgent performance, and I think that John Caird came up with a production to match it. I have never seen a less tense, exciting Macbeth than this. It was dreary in the extreme. Most of the supporting actors were like a provincial rep production. I think it was close to a disgrace, and it's very bad news for the Almeida. They've now had three flops on the trot. They had the dreadful Graham Greene musical, they had that really pointless play by Peter Whelan about the Pre-Raphaelites, and now this really, really very poor Macbeth.
I want to leap to the defence of the supporting cast, who I think had the potential to be much better than they may have appeared to Charlie. I think what's happened on this show is what happens when you've got a very, very charismatic leading actor sometimes, and a kind of compliant production. You get the leading actor setting up a rhythm, exactly as Adrian Lester did at the Young Vic when he played Hamlet. Lester is an actor with fantastically kind of low centre of gravity. He's incredibly relaxed. He spoke very, very quietly and with very, very low energy. He, however, energised it, so everybody else was doing exactly the same thing, only they couldn't do it. And similarly, because Simon Russell Beale in this production is pausing at the end of every single idea. So every single thought is separately delineated. So you get lines like when he's talking to Lady Macbeth and he says, "Be innocent of the knowledge, beat, dearest Chuck." Then he thinks about that. So there's two beats. Then he says, "Till thou applaud the deed." At which point, you know, the excitement has drained. Now, everybody else is also doing that, which occasionally yields really interesting results. There are entire scenes and relationships I'd never really noticed before. There's a great scene with Malcolm at what is the beginning of the second half in this production, where they discuss virtues of kingship, which I've never really noticed before. And that really worked, and I think there's a terrific performance of Ross by Billy Carter. There are good things in it, but they get lost because this production plays every single scene at exactly the same pace.
Somebody made a very interesting observation to me in the interval, though, which hadn't struck me, but it made so much sense when he said it, which is that it's as if Russell Beale has gone through the text like a comedian would go through it, teasing out every single nuance in the language. And sometimes that really rebounded on him, such as the Banquo scene when he actually got laughs, which I have never, ever seen when Banquo appears. But that certainly in a way would account for, you know, the way that he decided to do it. Heather, would you agree with that? Does that make sense?
Well, I just thought he was miscast. I mean, I think he's a brilliant actor and he was a very good Hamlet, but he's still playing Hamlet. And so, in other words, I thought what we saw was half a brilliant Macbeth, because he took you inside this dreadful, agonised mind, but you never believed that he could actually have taken any of the actions. There was no excitement, no sense of the opposite, as you said already, of the Danny Sapani production, where it was all action and not much insight. There was almost too much insight. But at the end, when he was on his own, and the way he said signifying nothing, you just thought he realizes he's gone through this hell, and it was for nothing. But to go back to production, I mean, it seemed to me that one of the things about it, which was meant presumably to hold it together, but which actually took it in odd directions, was giving the Weird Sisters an authorial role, where they seem to be running the action, but Shakespearean tragedy isn't like Greek tragedy, where the gods run things and it's out of the people's hands. They seem to be too much in control of the action, so that at the end they actually blow out the brief candle of his life.
Yes.
Satisfied, it is finished. And I thought that gave them far too much of a role, in fact.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I think you're right, because what that does is it somehow gets rid of Macbeth's authority.
Macbeth's responsibility, yes. Mm.
Well, I have to say, I disagree profoundly with you all about Simon Russell-Veal's performance as Macbeth. While Charlie would have been down at Starbucks ordering a coffee, I would have been there enjoying the kind of the new light that was seen to be being thrown on the language. I spotted all kinds of things in the play that I hadn't spotted before, and I've read it a lot and I've seen it a lot. And it was just the way that he could make a word like black sound like it had about 10 syllables.
I think you're absolutely right. But I think what we got there was it's beautifully lit literary criticism, sort of beautifully enunciated and understood. I mean, thrillingly understood by Russell Veal. There's no getting away from the fact that this man is a really, really important and serious actor who, as you say, was shedding unbelievable light on whole passages, not just individual words, whole passages that other actors gloss over because they're not really sure what they'll do with it. So they just get very energetic on it, and he does entirely the reverse, which is fantastic. But if you're going to do that, then you have to have a production to support it. The better the actor, the more they need a good director, because if you're a really good actor, you have more and more ideas, and therefore you need a director to come in and go, that one's really good, but the one you had yesterday was better, and therefore let's fashion this scene in that way. Let's structure it.
Can we move on and talk then a bit more about some of the ideas that are in the production? And one of the ideas is what it plays hugely on, the Macbeth's loss of a young child. I found this extremely moving, Charlie. How did you think it worked? What they did?
Well, it should have moved me, because I'm the father of an IVF child and have been through childlessness, and it didn't. Partly because I thought that the relationship between Macbeth and Lady Macbeth was actually curiously blank, and that was part of it. The second was that this childlessness had somehow brought on the murderous ambition and in a way justified it. And I think that is both sentimental and glib. And there were children floating away, floating around all the way through this production, and it was clear that the Macbeths didn't have any. There was one moment where he put his arm round Fleon's. I did find that bit touching. But it just seemed glib to me, and it was what I think both Russell Veal and Caird got into a kind of sort of folie à deux on this, which was that Macbeth was somehow redeemable, and that he just went a little bit too far, and that to understand all is to forgive all. And actually what this play needs above all is to create a thrilling sense of evil, and there didn't seem to me to be any evil there. I wasn't scared for a moment, not a moment. And it's all very well saying, yes, he does deliver the speeches, he does find great meaning in them, and much more than most actors. But if you're missing what's the essential quality of the play, that seems to me to be and it's a very interesting what David was saying. I interviewed Russell Veal once, and he did actually say he saw acting as three-dimensional literary criticism. And I think on this occasion, the literary critic has completely taken over from the actor.
And I think that point you made about the Macbeths not connecting as a couple, Emma Fielding is a really considerable actor, but actually I suspect that it's seriously frustrating in this production to be on stage with Russell Veal, because it's so solipsistic. I mean, he's the least selfish of men. I've met him about once, but you just watch him on stage and he usually gives stuff off to other people. But actually, the conception of this production is he is a man absolutely besieged by and trapped in his own thought. So very few people on that stage get to connect with him, because he's not actually in the present. He's kind of stuck in his own thoughts. So poor Emma Fielding is there trying to communicate with a man that is at a loss because he's so busy communicating with himself.
Yes, he's isolated and self-absorbed. But that you do get the exact moment when she thinks she's lost him. The fainting at the news that he's killed the guards seemed to me to be the result of her absolute shock, and she suddenly doesn't know this man anymore. They were in it together, and now they're not. She doesn't know him anymore. He's taken off on a route without her. And I did think that the backstory, which all directors go in for now, of course, about the loss of a child, did come over very clearly, and her leading off what seemed to be a child and at the end in the sleepwalking scene was actually quite moving.
I think it's also worth saying, I mean, John Caird has had a really terrible year. He directed Rattle of a Simple Man. He then directed Beckett. And now he's made a complete Horlicks of Macbeth, and I think it's time he took a rest.
David, any difference to that?
Well, difficult to follow that, but I do think this is one of those productions that is enthralled to the enormous talent of its leading actor, which is not necessarily a healthy way to put on a show. But also, it's a production that feels like they're stuck in week three of rehearsals. They're stuck in week three where they are mining the text for detail. If all you want is the detail, if all you want, it's like shooting an entire movie in close-up, which, of course, moment by moment, is rather interesting. You get to see bits of costume. You know, you get to see all of that, but you never get the big picture. And as Charlie says, you're not moved by it, you're not scared by it, at which point you think, it's failing.
Heather, do you think there is any reason for people to go along and see it?
I think it'd be hard to get a ticket, actually, because Simon Russell Beale has already sold it out. But, well, yes, I mean, I wouldn't say it's a disaster at all, because there are insights which Simon Russell Beale gives you, and I also liked Emma Fielding, as a matter of fact.
So. Yes. And I just have to say, just from loving the language, I it could have gone on for 4 hours like the Lear, and I would have been perfectly happy. So, but anyway, thank you very much, Heather Neal, David Benedict, and Charlie Spencer.